producers, panelists, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening and welcome to follow the public event Women in Science and Society, organized by Jyväskylä Summer School. My name is Elina Sievänen and I work as Academic Research Fellow and University Lecturer at Department of Chemistry of University of Jyväskylä. Moreover, I act as the chairman of the organizing committee of this year's Jyväskylä Summer School, which is the 23rd of its kind. Jyväskylä Summer School has established itself as one of the largest and most high-quality interdisciplinary summer schools in Finland, offering this year 24 courses in the areas of biology, chemistry, environmental sciences, information technology, mathematics, physics, renewable energy, and statistics. The summer school is organized together with the faculties of mathematics and science and information technology of University of Jyväskylä, and it takes place at the Mattilaniemi and Ylistönrinne campuses for a time period of 2.5 weeks. The summer school gathers together hundreds, 460 to be precise, of advanced undergraduate and doctoral students, as well as postdoctoral researchers. This year, the students represent almost 40 different nationalities. As teachers, we have the pleasure to have 36 international top specialists of their own fields from over 10 different countries. Besides science, the summer school offers a comprehensive social program representing in a versatile way the Finnish nature and culture. The annual public lecture is also part of the social program of the summer school. Its aim is to bring the university and the citizens of Jyväskylä closer together, as well as to function as a window to the university world. We will familiarize ourselves to the subject of today, women in science and society, by two introductions, after which the panelists will discuss about the subject. Also, the audience will have a chance to participate in the discussion. Our first introducer, Anna Swan, is an associate professor in the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department at Boston University. She received her master's degree in physics engineering from Chalmers University, Gothenburg, Sweden, and her PhD degree in physics from Boston University. Her research interests include optical properties of low-dimensional systems, such as carbon nanotubes and graphene, as well as biological imaging and detection using interference techniques. Moreover, Professor Swan is a member of a consortium called Four Schools for Women in Engineering. It consists of four engineering colleges in Massachusetts, united in commitment to gender equity in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Each partner of the consortium has a strong record of outreach and program delivery, as well as of teacher training and programming for girls and women in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics-related areas. By joining forces, the consortium hopes to develop a model to demonstrate how engineering concepts become part of the middle school curriculum in ways that encourage girls as well as boys to continue along the engineering pathway. Now it is my pleasure to give the stand to Professor Anna Swan. Please.
My husband, who is in theater, is a little worried there because I haven't turned that sound on. My education is I did physics as an undergraduate in Sweden, And at that point, we were 10 girls and 100 students, so 10%. And then I went on to my PhD studies in physics, and it was the same numbers, 10 women, about 100 students. And those numbers have, this is a long time ago, by the way, hasn't really changed. They stay the same. It's very flat, no development. My field, as you heard, is in optics, carbon nanotubes, and graphene mostly these days, and that's why I'm here. I'm teaching a course in that in the summer school, and we're basically almost halfway through, and it's, for at least for me, it's been a lot of fun. I'm probably in a technical field because of the influence of my mother. She is a chemical engineer, and she, when she went to what's called KTH in Swedish, the Royal Technical Institute in Stockholm, she was the first person from her family to go to college, and the four girls in her course were greeted by the rector or the president of that university saying, "You're wasting space. You're just going to get married and disappear out of the workforce. So you're taking valuable space from the men." My mother stayed in the field. She had a long and successful career. She's retired now, working in the pulp and paper industry, which is important here in Finland too. She was doing research and development there. And she has told me a lot of things about this. But then a couple of years when I was a teenager, she was also lent out to paper mill in our town because they had problems. So they needed somebody to come in and clean it up, so to speak. She was there for a couple of years. Apparently it went well. And I didn't know anything more about this until at her 75th birthday party. You know, I'm sure in Finland, like in Sweden, people give toasts and you hear all kinds of stories. And then I found out that when she got there, she was probably the only woman on the floor of the factory. There were secretaries, but they were safely ensconced in nice offices someplace else. So on this factory floor, there are all these pin-up pictures of naked women in different poses. That didn't sit too well with my mother. So she figured that she had to do something about this. A little dose of their own medicine, she found a big poster of an attractive male with a huge erection that she put on her office door. And apparently all pictures came down very quickly after that. It was all gone. So she was first treated as an unwelcome person to the field, and you'll see. And things have definitely changed since then. I never experienced any of these kind of overt problems being a woman in science. I actually have had a very nice experience through my education and have had good mentors. My PhD mentor, Michael Badanuni, has been very important for me. And also I think part of what made him so great, he really kept standards the same for all his students, so women, female. He didn't care, and that was very good. In terms of are there any problems left? Well, one thing is this thing about the low numbers. There are very few women. And I would also say this. What I'm saying for women, I think, also goes for minorities. There are few women, there are few minorities in science. And is that a problem? Well, there was just last week a report out from the U.S. that in the next decade we'll probably be short 1 million people in the STEM fields. And when I'm going to say STEM a lot, STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. So these technical fields. as a society, at least in the U.S., and I imagine things will be similar in other countries, we need more people in the STEM fields to progress. And there's a huge untapped pool of talent in women and minorities. to get into this field, I'm a physicist, so I maybe it's self-serving to say this, but I think if you study physics in high school, chances are that you can go on and study technical fields at a higher level. And if you look in the U.S., there are more young men than young women that take physics in high school. In the U.S., you don't have to take physics, by the way. You can skip it if you want. You can take some other science. So this recent Texas study looked at this, and they looked at 1,000 different schools. So they had a large number of students, and they found that the aggregate numbers, of course, show what we already knew. There are more men than women in physics. But if they looked, they saw that this was a large fluctuation. And in many cases, you found places where there were no difference. There were same number of girls and boys in the physics classes. And in some cases, there were a lot more girls than boys in the physics classes. So they tried to figure out, why is there such big variation? And what they found is it's related to not necessarily if your mother is a scientist, but if there are a large pool of women in the STEM fields in your local community. The thing is, if you go to your friend's birthday party and the mother comes with a cake and she happens to be an astrophysicist, that's kind of normal, and that means that you can probably do something like that too. And that encourages the girls to go into physics and maybe become a physics professor, or in my case, an engineering professor. So why are there so few women in these fields? Just before we left for vacation in Sweden, I went to a colleague in the social scientist in psychology who lent me a book. It's called Why So Slow by Virginia Vanian, and I recommend it. I haven't read the whole book yet, but it's very interesting, and it talks a lot about these things. And she has something that she called gender schemas, or gender bias, which is something that we have that simplifies our life. It's based on our common experiences. So if you've seen things that fall into a pattern, then you think it's true. For example, men are on average taller than women. You know, you can just tally it all up, and there it is. Of course, there's a large distribution of these numbers. So, of course, you can have a woman that's taller than a man. But on average, it's true that men are taller than women. And now, height is something that's actually very simple to measure. Like, it's, you know, if somebody's taller or shorter than the other person. But still, when we see people, we will assume that the guy is taller than the gal because we have these patterns. And it doesn't need to be true at all. And another study showed that this is people, where their doorways, chairs, and so forth, people, men and women, always think that the guy is taller than the woman, even if they're not. So that's part of this simplification, gender schemas that we all hold. Another thing is occupations. There are more men in technical occupations than women. So if you have a married couple and one of them is the engineer and the other is the arts administrator, then the assumption is that the guy is the engineer and the woman is the arts administrator. And most of the time that's probably true. I'm taking this example because it's me and my husband, so in this case it's the opposite, right? So you always can have the opposite, but you tend to believe that this is the case. So I'm going to another study from last year from Yale that went out to over 100 professors in the U.S., asking them to evaluate undergrad lab assistants, you know, how what quality they had, if they were sort of hireable, what salary they should be, and if they were worth mentoring, you know, what potential they had. And so there were equal number of female and male undergrad students' CVs that were sent out to these professors. And the result coming in saw that the males were evaluated better. They were stronger. They had a better skill level, competence, by maybe 15-20%. They all had also higher potential for advancement, so more likely to be mentored. And the salary suggested for these two cases was, for the men, on average, 30,000, and for the women, $26,000 a year. And both female and male professors were agreeing on these numbers. I mean, they were not agreeing, sitting, discussing, but that this came out from they sent back the replies. So the interesting thing about this study is that there was the identical CV sent to everybody just with a male or a female name on. So in this case, there was absolutely no difference in the application except for the name. And I hope this sinks in, guys, because this is really something. This is what she's talking about, these gender schemas that we all carry. And I also want to emphasize that the women professor were just as likely to do this as the male professor. No difference. Maybe a little bigger in spread in evaluation between the women, but on average, the same result. And if you are a man in a field that's dominated by men, you're likely to get that extra little boost. Everybody will believe that you are better because, on average, men are successful in that field. So it's important to think about when you hire people, when you discuss salary raises, when you discuss promotions, all these things. If you're always thinking that the dominant party is better, even though you're equal, that is going to add up, actually multiplies, because these effects are multiplicative. So that gives you a large spread in the end. So what is the solution to this? Of course, is if you have a more equal distribution of men and women, successful men and women in a field, this gender schema will disappear because then it equalizes. So if we manage to get equal distribution of men and women or close to equal, it's not going to be such an issue. But this is a little bit the chicken and egg because, as I just told you, this study of the high school students, you're more likely to get students in if you have role models. And just in this case, you have lacking role models. So I want to talk a little bit about what we are doing at Boston University. And first, I'm going to talk a little bit about the role models, which in this case is the female faculty. And in terms of numbers, it's pretty poor. I'm in my department, I'm the only tenured professor. There are two tenure track professors, and there's 45 professors overall. So that's a pretty low percentage. I don't know if you know about the U.S. system. I think here in Finland, what you have is like you have few full professors, and then there are more. It's like a pyramid like this. In the U.S., the pyramid is like that because everybody you get hired as an assistant professor, and then if you make it to tenure, you should have just a short part of your career in the associate professorship, and then you go on to be full professor And you can be that till you die. There's actually no retirement age enforced in the U.S. You can be a professor till you're 70, 80, 90. Anyway, so if you look at it, if you look at the men, the majority of the men are full professors. And if you look at the women, there are very few full professors. They're all at the earlier stages. And you think, well, maybe that's because it's like the field is developing and it hasn't been time to hire and so forth. No, that's not the case. As I told you, it's been the same situation, the same numbers for 20 years. So what happens is that women come up through the ranks, and then for some reason, they find a better offer elsewhere. And this happened to a colleague of mine that just got tenure last year. She got hired away to Switzerland. She got a great position. Another colleague of mine got a great position in Washington and 40% salary raise and so forth. So of course, they go. Why shouldn't they? So what's the problem? Well, I think the problem in our institution is that we hire in senior male faculty, but we haven't gotten to the point where we can ambush other schools and get senior female faculty. That hasn't happened yet. And I think that's part of this assumption that if you want a stellar senior person, that stellar senior person in engineering is a guy. So what have we done? Well, I have been involved in some things. You mentioned one thing, I'm going to talk first about something that some colleagues of me started 9 years ago, which is an organization for female faculty called WISE. WISE standing for Women in Science and Engineering. And this is really a grassroots thing. Sharon Grace got a few people together, got money from the provost, and starting getting all women in engineering, math, physics, biology, chemistry, and social sciences together. And I want to say it's been really important to have a social scientist in this group because they study these issues. And as a scientist, I study science. I really don't study gender roles. That's not my field. I never think of this, except now I was asked to talk about it, so now I thought about it. I mean, of course I think about it, but it's not my field. That's what I want to say. So I think that group has accomplished quite a lot. Thought about best hiring practices to get past biases, like I just talked about, when you're hiring people. And they have been adopted by the college. I don't think they're followed, but at least they're adopted. So that's step number one. The other very important part that WISE has done is data collection. You have to have data if you want to change something. You have to show what the situation is, and if there's a problem, it's going to show up in the data, and then you can address it. This is inspired, of course, by a famous thing done by Nancy Hopkins at MIT. I don't know if some of you might have heard of that. She wanted 200 square foot more of lab space for a new research direction. She was denied several times. She got out a tape measure and measured her labs, measured everybody's lab, and showed that women professors had, full professors had less lab space than entering male assistant professors. That got the attention of people, and things have been changing. Okay, so we still have issues with the number of female faculty, but let's think about the students that we do have, the undergrads. We want to have retention so they don't drop out, so we can increase these numbers in the pipeline. And we started some program called WISE at Warren. Warren is a student dormitory. So they are the freshman women that choose to do this. They live together in one floor. They're all in the STEM field. They have upperclassmen that live with them, that mentors them, takes care of them, and they have interaction with faculty on a regular basis, and they have workshops, skill building, all these kind of things. And my involvement in that is not so taxing. I go to lunch maybe once a year. I give a lab tour maybe once a year. And you don't know this, but we're going to have a barbecue with the new students come first weekend of the fall. That has worked really well. This has been going for 6 years. And this, if you look at this group of students, of course, this is small numbers. It's 44 students each year on this floor. But they have much better retention rates. The graduation rate in sciences is 77% compared to the other FEMAs, which is only 46%. So that's a big positive change. And hopefully that will hold when the numbers build too. I think so. The other thing is that even if they switch out from science and go into some other field, they have a higher graduation rate from the university. And on the whole, they take more STEM-related classes and have slightly higher grade average than women. But I think the main point is that they feel like they have this is where they belong. They are part of this. They have a community. They have a social network. It's very important. Actually, I also want to go back to this WISE for the faculty. That's been done tremendous things for the women faculty. I told you I'm one of the just three women in my faculty, and the other women are in different fields, so I don't talk to them on a professional basis so much. It's really been good for networking. A colleague of mine who's been at BU for 35 years said before WISE she only knows three other women at BU. So you can imagine, and all of a sudden you have this network of 60 people. So it's good. I think I'm going to stop there. And I said, despite there are some problems, and not so big ones, but I think it's a very good field for women to be in the sciences. And even if salaries might be a little lower for women still, even in sciences, the salary overall is higher because it's a mass-dominated field, so it has good salaries. And then the other benefit, of course, is as a scientist, you get to go to very nice places, including UVSCULE. So thank you, everybody. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much, Professor Swan, for this very intriguing and inspiring speech. Our second introducer, Hannele Harkonen, was awarded with a degree of Doctor in Social Sciences with Gender Studies as the major subject in 2009 at the University of Jyväskylä. Her dissertation, Women and Fat, Approaches to the Social Study of Fatness, dealt with fatness from points of view of social gender studies and the so-called critical fatness research. As a researcher, Harjunen is interested in investigating the body and the corporality, in particular, viewing the influence of the gender and the dominant norms. Recently, she has turned her research interests also towards intersectionality. During the time period from 2007 to 2009, she worked as a researcher at Umeå University, Sweden, in a research project, The Quality of Gender and Equality Policies in the European Union. Her currently ongoing postdoctoral research project is called The Construction of Neoliberal Bodies, and it deals with the effect of neoliberal economy on bodily impressions and experiences. She is also involved in a consortium project, Fatty Foods,
and fat bodies, diversification of ideals and practices of healthy eating. And this project is funded by the Academy of Finland. And in addition to University of Jyväskylä, it involves National Consumer Research Center and National Public Health Institute of Finland. So I will give the floor to Dr. Harjunen, please.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Indeed, my name is Hannele Harjunen, and I come from the Department of Social Sciences and Philosophy. Let's see. This is the title of my talk today. I have to say that I'm really glad that Jyväskylä Summer School has included this topic in the program. It's very topical, but it's very often ignored. Although women's position in science, academia, and society is a really, really important question for the future of universities in general. And I'm especially looking forward to the panel discussion. I think I've got about 20 minutes today. I will speak about gender and academia, and especially the gender bias that is prevalent in academia. And my talk has been inspired, and it draws from this research. It's a recent report by the Nordic Council of Ministers. It came out in June this year. The Nordic region, a step closer to gender balance in research. Joint Nordic strategies and measures to promote gender balance among researchers in academia. Also use other materials, mostly the research I'm drawing from is either Nordic, European, or comes from the United States, so that you know that I kind of center there. I'll start by showing you a figure concerning the proportion of women and men at different stages of academic career ladder. The figure illustrates the situation in the Nordic region and 27 European Union countries at the moment. This is probably not that surprising to you, at least to those of you who have spent a little more time in the academy. The figure shows us the proportion of men and women at typical career points. Firstly, on the left there, you see students up to the including master's level. And there you can see that female students are the majority, both in EU and in the Nordic region. Around 60% female students, around 40, a little bit over male students. The next point, grade D on the figure, is doctoral students. Grade C is postdoc students, postdoc level. Grade B, associate professors. And grade A, full professors. Firstly, what we see here is that women comprise the majority of the students who have completed master's degree. Secondly, we see that there is still a relative gender balance among those who have completed doctoral thesis. That's the point D. Also, we can tell that women's career development starts to slow down at the postdoc level. In Europe, usually associate professor level, in the Nordic, in Europe at postdoc level, and in the Nordic countries in the associate professor level. And we can also see that at the highest level, academia does not have the proportion of women expected, that is, among professors. So this is a very typical scissor-shaped figure. And as you can see, it follows the same path for both, pretty much the same path for both European Union and the Nordic countries. So women's proportion of doctoral degrees and professorships has increased in the Nordic countries as well as in many parts of Europe. However, the career cycle of women and men in the research system still shows clear gender differences. Women are proportionally underrepresented in almost all leadership and decision-making bodies in academia. They are underrepresented as members of scientific boards and committees, as professors, heads of faculties, rectors, and so on. Lack of women in top positions in academia is symptomatic of the gender bias, or more accurately, we could call it the male bias, that is prevalent in academia and in society in general, not just academia. Male bias can be detected on all levels of academia, and it has an impact on most academic practices and activities. The male bias becomes especially visible during the postdoc stage and during early career. Postdoc phase is crucial for women, especially. It determines whether they are going to stay within academia or within research world, or whether they are going to leave it. More women than men choose to leave academia at the postdoc phase. For example, a recent report concerning UK doctoral students in the field of chemistry showed that more women than men intend to pursue a career in research when they start their doctoral studies, almost 72% compared to the males, 65%. But by the time they finish their doctoral thesis, this has dropped to 37% for women. Among the reported reasons are experienced lack of support, lack of supervision, and poor job security and career prospects after finishing the doctoral's degree. These aforementioned factors might, of course, concern everyone, regardless of gender. But for women, there's an extra hurdle. The male bias, sexism, and gender discrimination in academia make it extra difficult for women to succeed beyond the crucial postdoc phase. Often female postdocs also lack confidence compared to their male counterparts, and they probably lack confidence because they do not get the same kind of support the males get. One obvious reason why women leave academia at the postdoc phase is that it coincides with the time when many choose to start a family. Family care duties start to have an impact on women's career. It has been shown that postdoc women with children spend more time on childcare than their husbands. They spend more of their time on child-rearing duties and are more likely to have a spouse who works as well. A specific term, the maternal wall, has been coined to describe the effect of having a family on one's career in academia has got. And you should know that there is no such thing as paternal wall. It is not only academia, though, that's the problem. Gender inequality in society and in the family, for example, unequal distribution of care duties and lack of daycare options, for example, accelerate gender inequality in academia at this point. Losing women at this point, however, means a huge loss of research potential and innovation, loss of investment and money, and it perpetuates academia as a male environment. Can we afford it? Should academia do something about it? So, there is a detectable male bias in academia. What it means is institutional, structural, both conscious and subconscious ways by which men are favored and privileged, and women undervalued and disadvantaged in academia. Male bias is embedded in the academic culture on institutional and structural levels, and overt sexism and discrimination also play a role. As we all know, academia as an institution is historically a male domain. The fact that women have been excluded from academia for the most part of its history has left its mark. Male thought, ideas, interests, ways of doing have been privileged and considered as the norm. Women have struggled to be included and taken seriously. Academia believes in noble ideas of neutrality and impartiality in research, but equality has not been one of its ideals. Academia draws from gendered social and cultural norms and practices. As an institution, it reflects and reproduces prevailing gender roles and imbalanced power relations in society. Inequality in society feeds inequality in academia and vice versa. As a result, gender bias that favors men is reproduced and maintained unless it's actively deconstructed. These are some of the examples how male bias shows in academia and society. I will be going into details a little bit later. For example, the horizontal and vertical segregation system in society and academia. There are male and female fields. This goes for especially Nordic countries where certain fields are almost exclusively male and certain others exclusively female. These fields also are assigned different types of prestige. Usually those fields that are male-dominated are seen as more prestigious. Also in academia, leadership has been traditionally perceived as male, and there still are those rampant, outdated, yet persistent ideas that knowledge, intelligence, and talent are inherently male qualities. These ideas are not only persistent within academia, they are persistent in society. And I want to give you an example, a recent example from 2012, how European Commission's research and innovation sector understands women's interests regarding science. Some of you might have seen this before. It's called Science, It's a Girl Thing. This was an actual advertisement that European Commission paid for and produced 2012. Yeah, it made me speechless as well. The commission said that the video had to speak girls' language to get the attention, and that it was intended to be fun, catchy, and strike a chord with young people. Unsurprisingly, this clip was pulled after only a few days, and after it received severe criticism, in particular from female scientists, who for some reason felt that their work comprises a little bit more than high heels, lipstick, and flirting with hot lab workers. And I really wanted to show you this clip because this is a good illustration of a kind of attitudes that linger on concerning women in science, in research, in academia. The assumption that girls would make decisions about their prospective careers on how girly the field is, and not because they have a genuine interest in science or research or career in research, is not only sexist but downright offensive. By dumbing down science, we are in fact dumbing down the girls and underestimating them severely. It is rather alarming to think that this would be the level of understanding of gender in the European Commission, which otherwise actively promotes gender mainstreaming and has pushed through a number of anti-discrimination laws, international legislations. I always get upset when I see that. But probably we're going to get a little bit more upset now. I have collected some examples of from recent research how male bias works in research communities. As you can see, the male bias works through all the levels of academia, all levels of academic activities. In the field of supervision and support, male students get better grades, disproportionately so, more supervision and encouragement towards carrying research. In recruitment, male candidates are favored. This is the same research I think Anna Case Swan was referring to. Male academics are favored when professors are recruited by invitation. This is one of the systems that is used in Finland, at least. I'm not sure if it's used in other places. And another point from that same research, and case one was referring to, was that, yes, men and women both discriminated against the very similar candidates, or the exactly same candidates, but the discrimination was especially clear when the board that decided on recruitment was all male. Getting published. This is where we see why it might get a little bit difficult for women in the postdoc phase. You're supposed to publish to survive in academia, and you are supposed to publish in prestigious journals. But what if your name alone makes it more difficult, if your name is a female name? Male academics' work gets published more often and in high-ranking academic journals. Female academics' work is not cited or not as often. And women are still relatively rare as first and last writers in papers. And the importance of the last writer is, of course, that the last writer is the project leader, the one who has got the funding. This goes on. Conferences, keynotes, academic invitations. Male academics have a higher acceptance rate to conferences. Moreover, they more often get oral representations as women get the poster representations. Male academics get more invitations to speak in symposia. They get invited to guest lecture, invitations to visit abroad, etc. And the funding example I have there, this is from the Nordic report. So-called centers of excellence have been established over the past 10 years, and they have been almost exclusively led by men, male academics. So, am I depressing you? I'm depressing myself. Do we have any solutions for this situation? On a structural, institutional level, there could be some solutions. What we need. First of all, we need gender-sensitive leadership. We know that there aren't any easy solutions to this, but we really do need academic leaders that do understand that gender bias, male bias, is a huge problem. And today it's not often recognized as such. And it's not dealt with in any systematic way. There are some tools at use, such as gender equality plans and such, but more often than not, they are not actively implemented. We also need analysis. We need careful examination of institutional, structural, and personal factors that maintain this gender inequality in academia. We need knowledge. We need gender-sensitive statistics, not just country level or university level. We need department level, faculty level statistics. We need gender training on all educational levels at the university, but especially the leadership level. We need implementation of these gender equality principles, concrete practices that aim to minimize the male bias and both overt and covert discrimination. and zero tolerance on sexual harassment should go without saying. We also need better monitoring. I have a question mark after sanctions because I'm not sure what they could be and what kind of sanctions would be effective in any way. But we might need them in any case. I will end my talk to words of Solveig Bergman. She's the one who wrote the Nordic report I showed you in the beginning. And I think these are the words of wisdom. Gender balance is not only a question of fairness. The credibility and legitimacy of research within society is enhanced when the research community reflects the population as a whole. It should be possible to recruit the most talented individuals to research, regardless of their gender. If the leaders at research institutions are not able to produce or recruit the most talented individuals of both genders, the quality of research will suffer. Today, the knowledge society, with its increased focus on research, is a major competitive advantage in the development of affluence. Women still represent an underutilized resource in academia. Research benefits when both genders participate and contribute with their expertise, creativity, and experience.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Swan and Dr. Hardiman. After your current and interviewing addresses, the panelists are without doubt eager to tackle the subject. But before giving them the floor, I, however, wish to express my sincere thanks to all of the panelists for accepting our invitation to this discussion. And we have a pleasure to have a wide-ranging and distinguished group of experts discussing about the subject. So if we start from the left side, there is Emerita Rector Aino Sallinen from Jyväskylä. Then we have Professor in Organic Chemistry, Maija Nissinen from Jyväskylä. Professor in Applied Physics, Päivi Törmä from Aalto University, Espoo. Academy Research Fellow Anna-Liisa Laine, representing evolutionary biology from Helsinki. Professor in Family Research, Kimmo Jokinen from Jyväskylä. And lecturer in Fatherhood Research, Jouko Huttunen from Jyväskylä. So I think we could start the panel discussion by an introductory round in the context with which each panelist could present her or himself in more detail and also speculate a little of their potential role in today's discussion. Rector Sallinen, I think you have the honor to start the discussion.
Thank you very much. Good evening, dear friends. It's good to be here again. So, first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting more females at this panel than men. I think it's a very good signal to the audience, and also reflects, I think, the atmosphere in Finland, because Finland is quite well known as a very advanced country in terms of equality issues. So Finland was the first one after New Zealand to give the right to vote for women. And we have had, for instance, female president in Finland for over 12 years. And nowadays, when we have a male president, some children are quite impressed. And they ask, is it possible also for men to be a president? So why I am here? I think because I'm the former rector of the university, and I was in charge of this university for more than 20 years. And I was the first female university rector in Finland and the second one in Scandinavia. So I have some experiences how it is to be the first one and face all kind of suspicions and also all kinds of possibilities that a female leader can have and offer. In addition to this, I would like to mention that also the University of Jyväskylä is also quite advanced in quality issues, because when the first Finnish language teacher training college was established in Jyväskylä in 1863, the first rector, Uno Cygnaeus, opened the career of a teacher to women. So it was very sensational in those days. And also, coming back to the university, about more than 10 years, or also for a couple of years, also some of my vice rectors, both of my vice rectors were women. So it was a world record, and I suggested that shouldn't it be mentioned in the Guinness record book, perhaps? But anyway, and in those days, having three female rectors at the running the university, we got very positive feedback also from our students, not only from our female students, but also from male students, that you are a very good role model to us.
Okay, I will speculate why I'm here. I suppose that the reason is that I'm still the only female chemistry professor here in Jyväskylä, although we have had over 50% of students, female students over, I don't know how many years, 20, 30 years. And I was also the first female chemistry professor. Some other reasons may be that I'm also the member of the Equality Committee of the university nowadays. And I think maybe the important reason was also that I'm a mother of the one-year-old boy. So I have an experience of combining career and being a mother.
Congratulations.
Hi, so I'm Päivi Törmä. And a professor of physics in Aalto University, as was said. And I think I'm here, well, I'm in a quite male-dominated field, actually. I was the second ever physics professor in Finland. And I also have links to Jyväskylä. I spent 6 wonderful years as a professor here in my early career. And then maybe apart from my scientific work, I have had a visibility in the national science politics in the Research and Innovation Council headed by the Prime Minister and in the Board of Academy of Finland. And I hope I was chosen also because I'm the kind of person who does not get depressed by the statistics. So, I mean, yeah, it's important to remind that the world is not as it should be, but while we are waiting for the ideal world to come, there are a lot of things that we women can do for ourselves and for other people, and I've been trying to do that.
Okay, so thank you again for the invitation. I think I'm partly here simply because I'm a woman doing science. I think that's enough qualification to be on this panel. And I come from one of those typical fields where master's students are mainly female, but then towards the pyramid of professors, males begin to dominate. And I'm doing more mathematical modeling, which I think is still perhaps a more male-dominated area in Finland and elsewhere. But I think perhaps more importantly, my mother was a scientist, and she was one of the first professors in her faculty, first female professors in her faculty. And now I'm a mother of young children. And it bothers me that motherhood is usually in public discussed as being this huge problem that we should solve in academia and in work life. Whereas I truly believe that I'm a better mother because I am a scientist. I worked on maternity leave always. I don't think that's a horrible thing to do. And I also think that I'm a better scientist because I'm a mother.
Okay, and I'm a sociologist and a man, but probably these are not reasons why I'm here. But I come from the field of family studies, and probably families play a crucial role when we think about women in academia, because both the family of origin, the support a woman gets from her parents in her studies, is a very important thing when we think about women in universities. And then, of course, the contemporary family, the family of choice. What is the division of labor? How do social norms in society support or not support gender roles, certain kind of gender roles? And how is the domestic, what is the division of domestic work? And that kind of things are very important when we think about women and as well men in universities and their academic life and academic career. And this evening I will probably talk quite much about family life and the connections between families and gender roles to universities. Thank you.
Well, you are already heard something about me, so, and I think I'm here now because I'm teaching here and I bring a perspective from the US. Thanks.
I hope I'm not invited here just because I'm a man. But I have been in many boards working for equality between men and women, and I have been there the only man. Especially I remember many years in men's subcommittee in the Council of Equality under the Ministry of Social Affairs and Health, and we made a lot of work also as a man for the equality between men and women. And my background is family research, and especially researching fathering and shared parenting. And I come from educational sciences and from the Department of Teacher Training, and I see that a lot of things comes from the family, especially for the children, the role models, but also the dynamics between the couple in the family. And may I have take I have wrote a story about James and Jane.
Yes,
would you like to hear it? Dementia. I have some statistics, but because I have no lecture, I let them be there. This story comes from many researches concerning the family dynamics and the gender roles between couples. First of all, pizza face. A lovely young couple is living together without any particular commitments to each other. Both are highly educated and devoted to working life with equally promising career expectations. So the question is about well-to-do people, young people who want to be equal, and maybe the lady is also a feminist, might be. So the second phase, I want a real family. The birth of the child represents a fulfillment of the couple relationship and contributes in reaching satisfying feelings of perfect family life. This is very often true with this kind of couples. In some day, they both want a real family, which means a child. After that comes differing commitments phase. Jane commits maybe totally to mothering, whilst James keeps on devoting to his work. James considers this arrangement as a natural and necessary arrangement, and Jane approves and agrees with this perhaps temporary, she thinks, temporary division of family obligations. And after that diverging careers phase, James becomes a good provider along his rising career, and Jane a good mother, occasionally with feelings of inadequacy and sense of giving up her career dreams. And the following phase, especially by Jane, I call it rationalizing phase. And it might be so that Jane would write, for instance, for her best friend this way: I'm lucky because I have got a good husband and a wonderful kid. And in fact, I prefer part-time work because I don't want to compete with colleagues and break a leg in the present-day working life. You know, the working life is hard and ugly nowadays. I call the James Bond in the family, but a little bit different way as you understand James Bond. Jane has a typical benevolent, nice husband, mostly like Butler James, many times giving some good message for Jane and giving a nice cup of tea. But actually, he is a bond for Jane, binding her tightly to be at home with the child, while he himself travels a lot abroad, promoting his career at numerous conferences and international projects. Do you think this is the end of the story? And is this is the only one story? There are many stories, but what do you think? You don't believe this? Thank you.
Okay, well, you've heard me already, but I'll just add that my background is not just in gender studies, but it's in social policy. So social and public policy are the fields that I actually come from originally.
Okay, thank you, panelists, for the introduction. I think most of the questions which I had written down dealt with somehow within the introductory speeches of Professor Swan and Dr. Harjunen, but probably it would be really interesting to know the panelists' opinions, personal opinions and experiences about some interesting issues. So if we move on to the university world, have you noticed in your experience, are there differences between the distribution of genders regarding different faculties and different major subjects? And if there are some differences, what are they like? I think, Professor Nissinen, maybe you could start this time.
Okay, I think in natural sciences, it's easy to see the difference. If you think about mathematics, I think still today maybe majority are men from starting students. When you go to physics, still men, right, baby? And in chemistry, like I said before, I think it has been like 20 years or so that majority of the starting students are female. And in biology, I think there's something like 70 or 80% are female. So I think it's also in natural sciences, you can see the division between hard science and soft science. And biology is sort of soft, chemistry is softer than physics and so on. But and I have also studied here in Jyväskylä some educational studies, and there it's dominated by female. So you can really see the difference between the different areas of academia.
Okay, Lecturer Huttunen, as a specialist in education, what would you say about this? Is it really so that most of the students in the teacher studies are female students?
Yes, actually they are. Most of them are females, and this has been a long... this is considered as a problem, but I think it is not so big problem, because there are no relevant ways to get more male students to teacher training. If we are want to make equal the situation equal for female and male candidates. Of course, many teachers in at school they think about this as a problem, and I understand them. But there are not any cheap and easy solutions. We have to wait for the next generation, the new men and new boys who really want to do something differently than their fathers have done in this respect.
Okay, what about family research then? I have understood that it is quite an interdisciplinary area, so what kind of areas are represented and what is the gender balance there?
Yes, it's very interdisciplinary area, but gender is not balanced there at all, because most of our researchers are female, of course, and I think that I'm almost the only man in this very field. But if I think of our Faculty of Social Sciences, it is true that most of our students are female, about 75-80% in sociology and social policy and social work. But then when we move towards professorships, then the amount of men grows very rapidly, it's clear. But I think that in our faculty, the gender question is not very bad answered. I mean that we have quite many female professors and lecturers, and there is quite good balance between the genders in this field. But if we take a closer look and take certain research fields, for example, social theory, because theory is always very highly appreciated in social sciences. Almost most of the researchers who are concentrating on social theory are men. And then when we move towards special fields, just as family studies or gender studies or childhood studies that are not so highly appreciated in social sciences, then the amount of female researchers grows very rapidly. And so, in a way, we have reached some kind of a gender equality, but in some other fields, not at all.
Okay, what about at Aalto University, Professor Dörmer, I think you are there like more in the mainly field, so to say, the technical department. So what is the situation there?
Yes, in Aalto University we have, of course, nowadays also the economics and the design and so on, there are more women there, but in the engineering and physics, computer science that we have, there are really small numbers of women, typically from, let's say, 10 to 30%, and maybe in chemistry a bit more. And this, obviously now, we are talking about a thing that we should get the message to the high school level, that people would think more broadly about their possible choices. Like, for instance, a lot of women that, in my opinion, could do science, engineering, and also business, be entrepreneurs, bosses of big companies, they go to the medicine faculty. This is a huge amount of talented Finnish females go to study medicine. So if we could get some of them to think about other options, I think it would be a benefit for the whole society, because we really need more people in engineering and science, as Professor Swan said, and also more force in the economy. And I think women could contribute more. So this message should go to the school and high school level. In the university, we cannot do anything about it anymore.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, because when I think myself as a high school student, I was also one of those who wanted to go to the medical school, and I didn't even know that there are alternatives like physics or chemistry or biology. Well, I had probably heard that it is possible to study those subjects at university, but I didn't have any idea about what they included, and I think this really is the message to high schools and schools, that there are other options if you're interested in sciences than medicine. What about Dr. Laine? You represent the biology department or the department of biosciences at Helsinki University. What is the situation there?
There's definitely, I think, more females when they enter the program, I think, almost regardless of which program it is within the biosciences. At least a few years ago in ecology and evolutionary biology, where I did my PhD, there were more female PhDs graduating than males. But then there's a black box. Something happens, because if you look at the professor level, that's really dominated by the men.
Okay, what about Dr. Harjunen? Do you have any comments or ideas about this? And what are your own experiences? What about gender studies? How is the gender balance there?
Gender studies is not a major at this university, but if you think about our introductory course, we have usually 140 students, and one-fifth usually are male. So that's quite a difference from the time when I started in the 90s, when it was about 100 girls and a couple of boys. So there's definitely more interest in not just gender studies, but also other fields of research that are encompassed by gender studies, like queer studies or intersectionality studies or other critical fields, like critical masculinity studies, which is part of gender studies usually. So
the interest of the male students towards gender studies has increased recently?
Yeah, not just gender studies, but all in all, the intersectionality as an idea. I don't know if you're familiar with intersectionality as a concept, but it means that there's not just one thing, one status identity that defines you. Usually you are something else as well, not only a male or female or something in between. You also might be white or homosexual or heterosexual or fat or whatever. And these intersecting identities usually are quite a bit more interesting than just focusing on one aspect of your identity or status. So I think intersectional thought, for its part, has brought a little bit more diversity in gender studies in any case, and that diversity includes male students.
What about the name gender studies then? When I visited the web pages of gender studies, in Finnish actually it was called women studies. Why is that?
Then we should get in touch with our webpage updater, perhaps, because it should be sukupuolentutkimus in Finnish as well, meaning gender studies.
Yeah.
Women's studies used to be the name for the topic, and since there was a growing discussion, not just in Finland or Nordic countries, but also in UK, USA, that at this moment, women's studies is not really perhaps the best descriptive term for what we do, because usually we don't believe in the so-called gender binary. There are not just men and women, there are other genders as well. So this name change reflects that people should be more welcome to get in. It's not some secret society for women.
Professor Swan, do you have any comments on this issue? How is the situation like? You already a little bit discussed about that in your speech, but is there something else you would like to comment?
No, it's just interesting to see that our local situation in the College of Engineering at BU seems to be extremely well reflected in the research that you showed here for EU and the northern countries. Maybe it's not surprising, but I didn't know we were so well matched. Exactly.
Okay, Rector Salinen, I think you have, as a long-term person who has led the university, you have some kind of idea about the gender balance of University of Jyväskylä in general. So what about the students in general? Are there any gender differences in the students?
Yes, and first you asked about potential differences between the faculties and disciplines.
Yes.
Okay, maybe I come to that particular question as well. But first of all, I would like to mention that I was elected rector 6 times in a row, and by a huge majority of men. Imagine it. So I think it's very typical of this university to be like that. So do something new and very bold, I think. And when you asked about these differences between faculties, so I have witnessed this kind of differences during these years, many years, and sitting by negotiation tables and discussing with people and also teaching at this university. So I'm a little bit hesitant of generalizing too much, but I think one of the most most visible differences between faculties and different types of research field is that particularly human sciences are basically and inherently very individualistic still, although there is some progress going on. Very individualistic. So there are big egos among those, and a high variation of ideas and objectives and everything how things should be done, whereas natural sciences are more collective, and from the very beginning of the studies, young students socialize to be in groups and also to work in groups and to have international experience, to go abroad, to go to international conferences and give papers and so on. So I have tried to encourage human sciences and students, particularly female students, to adopt such kind of behavioral models as well, to be in order to be more international, to be bolder in their how to utilize their academic skills and so on. And for instance, I have found it very easy, because I come from the humanistic areas. Also, I have studied also many other things as humanistic areas. I have found it very easy to negotiate with scientists. So there is a big difference at the negotiation table, for instance, be they social scientists or from education or from humanities and from information technology or from sport, because that's the only faculty of sport in Finland. They are different as well. So from natural sciences. So, for instance, in negotiations, at the negotiation culture within natural scientists and academics there is very direct and straightforward. So, and it's very easy to make decisions with them. So it does not take too much time. So it takes more time to go with social scientists, because they are critical and they have many options and how it should be and how it should not be, and that so on. But these natural scientists, they rely on facts. And they say, okay, let's do the decision and let's go away and do the implementation of it. So I have loved to negotiate in such kind of a culture. There are sure differences. And I think students, because they socialize themselves in this kind of cultural contexts, so particularly female students should be more or have more encouragement in all their activities. And I cannot avoid by telling that when I look back to my history as rector, so I have received more direct feedback from male than from female. That's a fact. And I think that we female, as well as men, we should encourage particularly female students to be bolder and to adopt leadership roles in groups and in society in general. And because there are also studies, because I come from communication, and as communication professor, I have also studied these kind of things. Many female students are so group-oriented in that sense that they don't want to stand alone or take individual responsibilities. And for instance, when Hannele Harju, you referred to the centers of excellence, and you said that they are so male-dominated. They sure are. And oh, how many discussions I have conducted at our university with some female professors in terms of centers of excellence, and try to encourage female professors to assume the role of the leader of a center of excellence. And usually the response has been, and the answer has been, no, we will share. There are a couple of females. We will share the leadership of the group. And I said, no, it's not possible. You must select one. And male professors do not hesitate to be the leader. So more encouragement in general for female students, regardless of the faculty of academic discipline.
Okay, then I would like to hear about your experiences about noticing any references about the existence of a glass ceiling that women sometimes refer to encounter when it comes to higher positions, such as professors, heads or departments, deans, CEOs, and so on. I think this subject has been referred to like many times within this discussion, and also the introductions. But what are your personal experiences? At least today, we have here several women who have not let the glass ceiling, if there is any, to prevent them from rising to high positions in the university world. So, Professor Törmä, I think you look quite eager to start. So what are your experiences on this?
Yeah, so first I should, maybe I'm not modest enough, but say that I have really got many things that complained here that they are not easy to reach. I will be soon a leader of Center of Excellence. I got the ERC Advanced Grant, which is the biggest thing a professor can get from EU, and so on and so on. So I would like to tell you that you should remember this, that yes, there is a glass ceiling, but in a country like Finland, it's normal window glass, and you can break it with a hammer. So this is really the case in our society, that it is a bit more difficult for women. I mean, to give numbers, this 26,000 versus 30,000 that Professor Swan told, it's probably true, but it's only 13%. So you are devaluated 13%. So with determination, you can overcome that. So you just have to believe in yourself and be determined. And I can tell you, when I was young, around 30, and I'm a very pragmatic person, I thought that, okay, there are less professors, female professors in physics. So is there a reason? Is there a difference between men and women? And I started to observe, and I promised that I will be very honest. And first I asked, are the boys more intelligent? And then I observed, and I concluded no. Then are they more hardworking? No. But then I found one interesting difference, because it seemed to me that young men were overestimating themselves, while girls were realistic. So then I concluded, okay, I have to start intentionally overestimate myself. And I did it, like, okay, let's behave like a star, and let's put a little bit too difficult goals and claim that I can reach them. And the worst thing was that I started to believe it myself. It really went to my head. Took many years to become realistic again. But it worked. So that is what I recommend to the girls in the audience. You have to overestimate yourself at least 13%.
Okay, Professor Swan, what about the situation in the United States? Have you experienced so-called glass ceiling, and has it influenced on your career?
Well, I don't have a big ERC, so I guess I should really start thinking about this 13% too. And I think you're very right. These observations feel very true to me too. So, I mean, I see a lot of my colleagues around me, and it's really... once you have sort of a certain baseline intelligence and that you need, it comes down to the will to really take on bigger things. And usually it is the male professors that decide to that they are the big leaders in you know, in their field. I have to say that just I'm very much enjoying being in science, and it really makes it possible to have such a big area of intake and influence when you are in this field. But I really have to work on my 13%, so I'm going to stop there.
Then probably we would like to hear a manly view about this glass ceiling. Maybe Professor Jokinen, you could comment. Have you noticed any glass ceiling regarding either of the genders?
Yes, I think that at least when we think statistically, it is clear that there exists this kind of a glass ceiling. If you just look how many women there are in professorships and in among the students, it's clear that there are still structures in our academic life that favors men students and men researchers. And now I have done recently only research work, but when I was teaching in our unit of sociology, it was very easy to see that the roles of male students differed radically from female students, and the men had a habit to take a role of expert. They believed themselves, and they all the time tried to show that they really do know what is going on, and they are experts in sociology. And female students, they mostly they just sat there in the seminar group and did not say anything. And it was very easy to see that the place was very gendered, and I think that it is still. But it is not only a question of university life. I think that we still have social norms in our society that favor traditional gender roles, or at least some traditional aspects in gender roles, although Nordic countries are forerunners in gender equality and we have had much new openings, etc. But personally, I do not have very many experiences of glass ceiling, but it's probably because I am a man. But I really believe that we still have, and a very strong one.
Dr. Salonen, how would you like to comment this issue? Have you experiences about glass ceiling, and if so, how are they like?
Well, I'm not quite sure. Perhaps personally, I have not experienced it, or I have broken it. And if there are glass ceilings, so they are there to be broken. Because if you think as a woman that there is a glass ceiling, so you might be very phlegmatic and not to do anything to break it. So I think we should challenge the whole concept of glass ceiling and go forward and not think about potential problems ahead, and do the best, and exactly what Päivi Törmä said, try to reach very high objectives. And maybe it's not a question of glass ceiling, so it's more a question of our own attitudes and even modest attitudes, and that we should go beyond them and challenge them.
Yes, I totally agree. I myself have not met any glass ceilings, although probably I'm not at that stage of my career yet. But anyway, I kind of also believe that if there is any glass ceiling, so then it is there to be broken, as said by many of the panelists. But I think the statistics, however, show that there is some kind of glass ceiling. Dr. Harjunen, would you like to comment on that?
I do appreciate strong women, and especially those women who have a strong will and do not stop, even if there are obstacles on their way. But I do think that there are also those women who had the potential to reach the top intellectually, but who don't have that kind of, let's say, stamina or power to fight those objects and obstacles. So I don't think we should only encourage those women who already have that kind of stamina to break through the glass ceiling. We also have to encourage those women who have the potential to be great, but perhaps do not have the kind of a strong personality or strong will that would take them there. And science, academia, research, in general, they are very competitive fields. And I do think that what women should learn is that no one is going to reward them for behaving well. It's not a good idea to be submissive. Be assertive if you can. If you can't, if you don't have that strength yourself, search out mentors who can do the fights for you.
Huttunen, what about you? I think you have also familiarized yourself with some statistics. So what are your comments on this issue?
It could be best to say that no comments. I understand that this issue comes very close to personal differences between people, and perhaps it is not a question about your sex, but it is a question what kind of values you have inherited or you keep in your mind. Or it's a very difficult question, and I have used to think that, but this is male opinion, not female opinion, that it would be a good thing that you can do anything you like, really. And I hope that also in university there could be different positions and which are equal in the sense that they are not evaluated along the salary or the leadership qualities needed in the position, because I think that happy workers and happy people would come also from this kind of a perspective. But I'm sure some are thinking that this is chauvinistic opinion, but I understand very well those women who don't want to be in the top, and still, even still, their life is valuable, and you can do very valuable work in the, also in the university.
Yes, Professor Swan, you wanted to comment.
I just wanted to comment about this thing with leadership. I think a lot of that is habit. If you're used to doing it from when you're young and as you go on, you are more likely to continue to be a leader. And we recently visited a college for my daughter Clara, who's soon going to apply to colleges. And this was an all-women's college. And they were pointing out that the leaders in Congress in the U.S., 30% of the women in Congress in the U.S. come from women's colleges. Although I think it's only a couple of percent of the women that go to all women's colleges. So that environment clearly fosters some leadership in women when because they have to. The things need to happen, and they are the ones that need to do it. So I think that's an interesting observation, that really changes things. And Hillary Clinton, for example, is a good one.
Okay, what about Dr. Leine? Do you have any experiences or any comments on this issue?
Well, I think a lot of the topics that I had in mind have been mentioned, but looking at the statistics, yes, definitely, there has to be a glass ceiling, but to identify exactly what it is, I think, is tremendously difficult. I think, for example, when we recruit personnel at universities nowadays, the process is quite transparent, so any discrimination at that level is quite difficult. But sometimes I think that maybe it's at the stage when you decide that, should we open a new professorship? How do we define it? That's a very mystical, cryptic process that really only few people have access to. That may be partly where some discrimination is. And I think, related to Anne's point, I think the role models are lacking, and that's partly maybe hindering women from going forth. Because if you don't see women in those top positions, you don't really know what to identify with. And so I think that's one component of the glass ceiling.
What comes to defining the professorship, I think Professor Nissinen has some personal experience on that, and it's not like discriminative towards her research area, but quite the opposite. So you were actually invited to your position. So what are your comments on this issue?
Yes, I was invited, and as also like Päivi said, that the obstacles that were presented in Dr. Harjunen's speech, I haven't experienced them personally. So I think I'm a bit the wrong person to answer. But of course, in the ideal world, I would like to think that when you are applying for a position, only the scientific competence is the thing that matters. But being realistic, I know that that's not always the case. And what I would like to comment on, and also referring to Päivi, that overemphasize yourself, I would also like to say that I think what female many times lack are the lack of confidence. They don't trust that they will get the position if they apply it, so they don't even start to apply it. So I think that's one problem. They don't even start to pursue the career in academics. And also other thing is networking. I think men are better in networking than female. So women should network themselves and also network with men, and that makes their life much easier when you know people, you know the right people.
Yes, Rector Salinen.
So may I add a couple of things, and I would like to support what Maija, you said just recently. So I have observed so many times that there is a huge lack of self-confidence among female teachers and maybe students as well within the academia. So more self-confidence, and also I have observed at the very same time such kind of phenomenon that many female academics even do not want to assume the role of leader and the leadership roles. They don't want to assume leadership roles. So it's not in those cases, they don't even try to reach that higher positions. So in that sense, it's not a question of a glass ceiling in my sense. So there are some obstacles within female themselves, and that's why I have encouraged, I have emphasized the need of encouragement and more self-confidence, as Maija said.
Yes, Professor Jokinen, and then Professor
Törmä. Yes, may I tell you two examples. I think that your ideas are, of course, very reasonable, but probably a little bit too individualistic in a way. When I visited Japan 2 years ago, I had a seminar group there in Matsue. It's a very traditional part in Japan, and there were only female students, and I asked them about their ideas of family life and academic life and career. And they said that they have two possibilities. Either they get married and have children and stay at home and learn to be housewives and mothers and say farewell to labor markets and career. Or they can remain single without children and probably also without husbands, because most of the men in that area were very traditionally oriented. And so their only choice was whether to be a housewife or a single woman who takes care of her career. And so there was a place for individual choice, but I think that it's not only a question of self-confidence, but also a question of youth societal and cultural structures. And then another example, last spring I was in South Korea, and I asked there about, there were some women researchers, and asked them about families and career. And they said that one of the researcher, female researcher, she said that she has three possibilities. First, she can marry, and it means that she must say goodbye to academic life. Or she can remain single and move towards career. Or thirdly, she can leave South Korea for example, Scandinavia. And here she will have more possibilities, both marry and have a career, because our societies are more liberal, and we have moved towards gender equality.
Hey, Professor Törmä.
Yeah, thank you. So, since there are, again, so many young people in the audience, I want to give concrete advice. So, for instance, for this self-confidence, okay, you can start to think yourself that I'm something, but concretely what you can do is what issue that has been mentioned here by many people, this mentoring. This means that you can contact successful, older, female person, somebody like what you would like to be, and ask that, can I get some mentoring? Like, a mentor is not your therapist, to whom you complain a lot, but you concretely ask for advice. And I have had this kind of mentors, very high-level people in this society, and it's extremely useful because they give you encouragement. You start to feel like, oh, I'm so great. And I have to say also this experienced females who have reached high positions, they know a lot of useful things that they cannot say publicly. So you better get to know them and get some mentoring, and it does not need to be a lot. Like 1 hour per year can make a huge difference.
Okay, I think it is now time to let the audience to take part in the discussion. So, if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to raise your hands, and then the panelists will comment. Yes, just a moment, we will get the mic.
Yes,
impossible.
Okay, probably Professor Terma, you brought this idea first to the discussion, so maybe you could start.
I would say impossible. No, but I feel that this slight overconfidence in young people, it would be a positive thing. It has been traditionally for centuries a driving force of our culture, that young people think that they can do something new and change the world and work hard and so on. So I view it positive, and I rather encourage women also to be like that, think that you can change the world. And I mean, men become realistic after 45 or something, so just wait.
Okay, does someone else want to comment? Yes, Dr. Harjanen?
I agree with you. I think I agree with you. I'm all for tearing down a little bit of the male privilege. I don't see the point why less than 50% of the world's population should think that they should be so overconfident about their abilities and whatever they are doing in their life. And this is the reason why we would need, for example, gender sensitivity training, because it's not just women who have gender, it's also men who have gender. So men could be made aware about this a little bit more than they are at the moment, that they indeed have many privileges that women do not enjoy in their everyday lives. But as long as we let men think, or women think, that it's the norm, that this is how it should be, that men have always been, for some reason, higher up in the hierarchy than women, then we just let it happen. Awareness training people. That's important.
Okay, Dr. Laine?
And I think we need to do something at the very early stages of childhood, because at least in Finland, the situation is now that our children are growing up into very defined sex roles from the very beginning. You see little girls in pink before they can talk, so you know that who's choosing their clothes. And so they grow up thinking of themselves strongly in sense of gender and then seeing these role models. And also in Finland, in the public discussion, mothers should stay at home until the children are 3 years old. And so what this means is, of course, that the father is the provider and the fathers are in the significant roles in the community. And children grow up believing this. And if these beliefs are put into children since they're babies, I think it's very hard to do anything. So we don't want to break anyone's confidence, but we should be bringing up children who think that they can do anything regardless of their gender.
Does anyone else want to comment on this? Yes, Rector Sallinen.
One question, we haven't had time to discuss it, but I think it's very important for female researchers to be able to reconcile both academic career and family life. So you mentioned that you have children, and for instance, when I gave birth to my daughter, so I felt that it was the most productive time in my publication career after she was born. So I was so productive. I felt so happy and so productive. So I published a lot in those months and years to come. So I think it must be possible also for a female to conduct a full life and not only one silo or one part of it. So it's possible. It's not easy. It's challenging, but it's possible, and it must be possible also for women.
Yes, exactly. Actually, the next issue I was going to ask about the panelists was really the family. So, of course, it is obvious that starting a family affects people's lives remarkably. And then I had thought that
often the mother stays home longer, but then I started to think, well, I cannot say this loud in this panel because this is like about equality. So I reformulated my sentence to often one of the parents, but let's face the truths, often it is the mother, of course, who stays longer home, taking care of the children. But do you think that this has some kind of consequences on the career development, and if there are any alternatives, and what is your opinion about the relevancy of this kind of discussion, you know, in general? Is this even relevant? Because we have seen women and men who have very successfully combined both career and family. And I think lecturer Huttunen, you could start, because I know that you have some probably a little bit exceptional experiences about this.
Yes, I think that this is a crucial question for women, because first of all, it is very important when you marry that you marry a right man, because it is not easy to change the husband. And the second thing is that you are able to educate the man. And of course, this is not the task of a woman. I mean that, for instance, maternity clinics should be, they should treat fathers as seriously as mothers, and make them commit themselves more tightly to their fatherhood than nowadays very often is the situation. And as to the parental leaves, it is very crucial that fathers should use family leaves more equally with mothers, because this would make it possible to a kind of a rotation or circulation between a father and mother in working and staying at home, because that is necessary, that you both, mother and father, take the similar responsibility at home in childcare and other things doing there. And the winner is as well the mother as the father, but perhaps a little bit different ways. The mother will get the possibility to go back to the work more easily, and the father will get the close connection to the child and to know him or her much better than otherwise would be. They both, it is a win-win situation. But I cannot understand why so few, in so few families, this happens, really. Do you know?
I think Professor Nissinen has some experience on this, but before that, I would like to comment my own situation when my son was born. So I actually thought in the beginning, before I gave birth to him, that, well, I will be on maternity leave for half a year, and then my husband will take care of my son at home for the second half of the year. But then I really didn't want to go back to work, because I was... spend more time with my baby, and I thought that he's so small, he really needs me and stuff like that. So probably there is also something in this regard, that the mothers in some cases won't let the fathers to take more responsibility. I have to say that then my husband stayed 3 months at home taking care of my son when he was 11 months old, and after that, so he also had the chance to take part in the life of the baby. But anyway, the time for that in my case came a little bit later than I thought. But probably, Professor Nissinen, you could comment on this.
I can totally relate to these feelings. I came back to work when my son was 7 months old, and my spouse took care of him for almost 5 months at home. I think it wasn't easy, to be honest. It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy for me. It wasn't easy for my spouse. I think it was easiest for our child. He didn't mind, as long as he get something to eat and good sleep, so he was happy. But I think that it is crucial for women scientists that they have the spouse who is willing to do some sacrifices also. And I mean by sacrifice that, for example, taking longer leave of absence from work to take care of the children. I think it's crucial. And as far as other family things, I want to mention that for me, perhaps starting a family was easier now because I have a permanent position. So I think if I have had children 10 years ago, it would have been more difficult. I think this was quite a good time, a good stage of my career to have children.
Okay, what about the other mothers of small children? Professor Törmä, how would you like to comment on this?
Yeah, my children are 7 and 11, so they are already big. And it's good that this topic came up, because really this combining a challenging career and family life, it's a big thing, and not only for women but also for young men in these times. And maternity leaves, well, with the first one I was 3 months at home, and then my husband 1 month, and then came the grandmother. And with the second one I was 6 months and my husband 5. And especially with the first one, I decided to take only three months. And now in Finland, it's usually 9 months. And now comes this societal pressure. So I'm a bad mother. But then I rationalized a bit that this is a thing that we have had for some time, this 9 months. But when my mother got me, the maternity leave was 1 month. So after 1 month, she went back to work, and I didn't turn out that bad. So then I thought that, okay, it won't be a problem. It wasn't a problem. So this was our story. But about this combining family and work, it helps a lot if you have a very organized attitude to it. And one concrete advice, again, now when you get a partner, especially before the children come, but at the latest when the children come, you really have to divide the housework systematically. So you can do it like this. First, you make a huge list of everything. Then this should include also the management, like organizing birthday parties for children, buying things, presents for relatives, and so on. And then you together give points to these according to how much time they take. Nobody knows which one will do which, so it's fair. And after giving the points, you start to choose one by one. Now it's your turn, your turn, your turn. And this works, because then there are no complaints that, okay, my works are heavy and so on, and if you can do another selection if you want. So this type of very pragmatic, organized attitude. And then when you do like this for 10 years, when the kids are small, you will be an excellent leader for any kind of thing.
Okay, what about Professor Swan? What about the situation in the United States? Do you have some experience about that? I think at least the maternity.
Yeah, so actually, obviously, this is a hot topic always among my colleagues. There's been a huge email trail about maternity leaves and what it means. In the U.S., there's very little. I think by legal, you can be gone for 6 weeks. When I had Clara, I got 3 months, which everybody thought was super generous of the company I was working for. And of course, I remember my aunt say that that's cruel. You only get to be home for 3 months. So it depends on your perspective. And also this thing about when is the best time to have children, because obviously, you know, things gets turned upside down. You don't sleep in the same way. You carry somebody all the time. I mean, things happen, obviously. It's a very different experience. And for women in academia in the U.S., where you have the tenure track system, so you're a graduate student, and so in your 20s, then you're a postdoc, then you get your faculty position, and then it's maybe 6 years when you're up for tenure. And that tenure is very important. If you don't get tenure, you're out. So, I mean, you can try somewhere else, but it's a lot of women decide to wait until after tenure to have children, so they have a position. And then, you know, you're older and maybe you don't get children. You know, it's a really complicated issue. And also, a lot of women in this discussion was very also upset, because there are things, some women say, oh, it's perfect to do this, and others say, oh no, it doesn't work because I couldn't get pregnant, I had to have several treatments in order to make this work. And other women say, why do we have to make this such a women's issue? And why do everybody assume that I want to have children? I don't want to have children. So. It's really one of those hot button issues for a lot of reasons, and it's too bad it's a women's issue, because it's really like a family issue or societal issue. It should be. It's not. I don't think it should be up to the individual to carry the full burden of having children. If nobody had children, we would all, you know, we would not be in good shape. We need somebody to pay for our retirement at some point. So it's really, and of course, in the I know that in the Scandinavian countries, it's much more enlightened, that there is more support for having children. But I think in some ways it's also a trap for women. They take time out, and it's wonderful to be with your children. It really is. But you lose in your career. Science doesn't stop just because you take a step back. And it's hard to regain that time you lost. You sort of have to catch up again. And also, it's very hard to do science part-time. It's like, I don't know if anybody ever read this tipping effect. You have to put a certain amount of work in before things really start to happen, when you do get that grant or that paper gets published or you get the invitations you need and so forth. It's very hard to do part-time. I don't want to scare anybody away, but it is a full-time job, I think. You can't do it part-time, although still very rewarding. Obviously, you can have a family. It's right there.
Okay, I think there is some comment in the audience, so please.
What I want to say is I want to just ask a question. You know, since I am in primary school, and everybody, I was told that I should be trust myself, and I should have the self-confidence. And I know that. But the truth is, every time I pay no attention to my own words, I ignore my opinion and don't believe, don't forget the rulers I just come up with. So I don't have, even I don't have the sense of security of my friendship. You know, all my friends, I think, is excellent. Because I know I need to get along with the friends who are very intelligent, brilliant, and who have the very serious requirement for themselves. So I just want to ask, the self-confidence, is it needed foundation of our knowledgeable or the beautiful appearance? Even we don't have this, where can we find the self-confidence? We know we need it, but we don't know how can we get it. That is a problem. Because always I think, only if one day I am smart and intelligent, or I have the, I become a beauty, that time I will be confident, really confident, because I have, that's true. But now if I just a student and without any successful, how can I see it? Where can I get this? Thank you.
Okay, I think you were very self-confident to have the courage to ask this question from the panel. And actually, I think you referred to the looks of the women, so that you feel more self-confident if you think that you look beautiful, and if you feel that there is something wrong in your appearance, so it also affects on your self-confidence in science, even though you know that you are really intelligent and bright and so on. So I think probably, Dr. Harjunen, you have researched this kind of issue, so maybe you have some comment on this.
I assure you that you are not alone with those feelings. Women in general, everywhere in the world, they are taught that their most prized possession or characteristic is their appearance. This is, of course, not true at all. And this is part of the problem why there are perhaps so few women or so few confident women who can break that glass ceiling and go to the top. Because women, girls, young women, women in general, they are not praised for their smarts, for their intelligence, for the wonderful qualities they have. Instead, attention is diverted to the size of their buttocks, for example. And that's not important. That doesn't matter. You don't think with your buttocks. You think with your brain. And we don't make this clear enough for young girls and young women. We say, you're such a beautiful girl. We should say, wow, you're a smart girl. And this is a big problem, and it would require a huge change how we educate our kids, how we raise our kids. It would require acknowledgement of those gender terms we use when raising the kids, when we are buying the kids clothes, when we are saying that you are such a smart boy, and we say that you are a very hardworking girl. We should be more sensitive to these things, and I really do hope that in future women are appreciated for those qualities that really do matter in life. But it's possible to gain confidence. You just surround yourself with people who actually appreciate your great qualities and not just some shallow shell. I feel like an inspirational speaker.
Okay.
But yes. Seriously.
Yes, I think Professor Gerber wants to comment.
Yeah, yeah. So there has been a lot of talk about the self-confidence, and of course, it has to be remembered that this is not a thing that, okay, I just decide. Self-confidence is like a muscle. You have to train years and years. I think for me, to become self-confident took like 25 years. So it takes a long time. It's a gradual process. Like you think that you want to run a marathon. You tell that, okay, tomorrow I do it. Little by little, you start training and it comes. And it comes from, as was said, by being around with people who appreciate you and getting these mentors who can help you, and then putting some challenges or targets to yourself, like difficult tasks that would, however, be important if you can reach them. And sometimes you will fail to reach them. This also raises your self-confidence if you manage to put yourself to try again after failing. And sometimes you will succeed, and this is also very good for your self-confidence. And then it comes with along many years, so you have to be patient.
Okay, Professor Jokinen?
Yes, I also think that self-confidence is, of course, something that is needed here. It helps a lot if you have that, but it is not a thing you just can take it or leave it. And, of course, all of us are also related. Relatedness is an elementary part of our life. So also our self-confidence is connected to our relationship towards our friends and spouses and mentors and children and teachers and other close people. And then we are all the time living in different kind of networks, and it is also important what kind of feedback we get and also what kind of feedback we give to other people. And so in universities, of course, we probably need more sensitiveness towards this kind of thing so that we can give positive feedback to our students and to our colleagues as well. And of course, homes also plays a very important role in this. And so I like to remind that self-confidence is not only an individual decision, and it's really not something that, okay, now I will be self-confident, and it's that. And it's a very complicated thing, but I agree that it is something that is really needed, and it also has some individual connections.
Yes, I agree what you said, but I would like to emphasize that you must start with yourself and not wait for the others to do something. Start with yourself and then try to accumulate this kind of emotional and attitudinal things.
And related to that, to really find the thing that you enjoy and you're passionate about. It's not that we decided one morning that, oh, I want to become a professor and I'm going to be confident, so I become a professor. I fell in love with disease ecology. All the questions about it fascinate me. And the deeper I got into it, the more knowledge I gained, the more confident I became in my area. And that passion is what drives you in research. You can network, you can make specific goals, but it's really, science is a crazy business, so you shouldn't pursue anything for these achievements themselves. You have to enjoy the process. So if you find something that you enjoy and you're good at it, then I think that's a good core for building also your identity and self-confidence.
Okay, there is also a question or comment in the audience.
Thank you. Does it work? I have many things I want to say, but the one thing that nobody has said is that all of you say that teaching children not to value themselves on their sex is an important thing. But to me, that's a thing that is clear. I never valued myself by my sex. I valued myself by me. And I feel that all you're saying starting with the point that there's a man and a woman and a family, and all of the questions related to that are keeping women from becoming advanced. But that's not true, because that's not the necessarily the basics of what family is. And that is clear to me. And I feel like maybe I have grown up in a society that is different from what you've grown up in. And maybe seeing it as I see makes the question kind of different. What is it in a woman that makes it difficult for her to reach the top level of hierarchy in academia? Because it's not necessarily the family. You can have a girlfriend. I can have a girlfriend instead of a boyfriend. And then the question is very different from whether or not it's me or my boyfriend that's more successful. And I think that is something we should think about.
Okay, Dr. Harjunen wants to comment on that, please.
I want to say this already earlier when you were talking about family and working life, combining them, because it's not, you're right, it's not just about the family. It's about combination of things. There are those structural things, for example, that matter. Like, I think it was Päivi Nissinen who referred to the fact that she felt confident that because she had permanent contract, it's a good time to have a kid. And this is exactly what's the problem with the postdoc phase for women. Most postdoc phase women are between the ages of 30 and 40. That's the time when quite a few of them want to have kids. At that point, most of those women don't have permanent contracts at the university. So it's a very different situation at that point to choose whether I want to have a kid and perhaps not come back to the university because I don't have any place there, perhaps, unless I'm indeed very well connected and I have some very powerful mentors who are going to have this project with lots of money and I'm going to get placed in that project. So it's much more complex issue. It's a combination of personal, family, structural, institutional issues, male bias. So that's what makes it so difficult to tackle. And I think what all these people here have commented on, they have told you their solutions, how they have found the combination of working life and family, for example. But you are right about that too, that these structures do have different types of expressions in different countries, and some societies are a little bit more sexist than others.
Are there any other questions or comments in the audience? I think there was the first one and then the second one. In here.
Okay, so I have a few comments. So first comment is, we were talking a lot about the settings and problems women get when we try to go to the top, but probably I thought we have a wrong people here to ask, because women we have here are probably totally successful, and probably the people we should ask about these settings is people who, some women who face this problem for some reason go away from science when we have a possibility to continue, and they don't continue. Because I'm a PhD student myself, I love science, and I don't understand why people would go away from it. So my question to the board here is to, why you see this gap between the number of master's students women and number of professor student female, and why women themselves explain this, why they leave this field.
I say something about that?
Yes, please. Yeah.
So I think if, you know, do you remember this thing about the 13% that we've been talking about, right? So if at every point, you know, there is a slightly bit uphill for women, and in some other field you could sort of more coast, right? Maybe the right thing is to go and do that and have a better life someplace else. Why should you, you know, be in pain all your life? I'm not saying that you will be, but that's a choice that people rightly can make. You know, that's there, and I think this thing. I have read this. I'm really enjoying this book by Virginia Vallian, I have to say. She also talks about something called stereotype threat, and if you say female scientist, you're already at a disadvantage because those two things don't go together in the big world. So now if I'm here on the panel because I'm a female scientist, I'm already at a disadvantage. And if you don't believe me, there's this, you can say to white males that Asians are much better in math, and then you give them a math test, their performance will drop. So I'm not kidding. So when you are, when the expectations are that you're going to perform less, chances are that you perform less. And the expectations are you're going to perform really well, chances are that you will. So these are the things that we need to work on and change, that the expectations are more positive for everyone and not only women. I think it's really important to also think about minorities who might have doubly problems because they might be, you know, disadvantaged in more than one way. And that's, I think, that's a real societal problem. And of course, you can do things as an individual, but then you're working slightly uphill all the time. Not that it's impossible, it's just a little bit harder.
Any other comments from the panel? Okay, then I think there was one more question in the audience.
So, hello to everybody. I got several comments. First one is sometime when I hear some of you talking as a male, as a guy, so I feel part of the problem, and like I don't feel part of the solution. So that's a bit hard for me. Something else I gotta say is that, still as a guy, when I see that women with high responsibility, I tend to respect them more and have more confidence in them because there is less women. So I guess they had to be harder than men to get to this position. So that's my point of view. Another comment, someone said that there is nothing to do about education and male getting education at some point. Well, I don't like the idea that there is nothing to do for something and that you have to wait for the next generation. So maybe the point could be educate, not wait for the next generation, but educate the parents or the people right now who will make the next generation. And what else? Oh, and I'd also like to know what you concretely do yourself, like daily, or what you do for making like this gender equality happen. So we had some nice concrete example, like this schedule thing, and I'd have to I'd like to hear of all of you what you do for gender equality day. So thank you for your time and listening.
Thank you. Actually, I think this is a really good point to go on to the final round, so that actually you could really comment on that. What do you really do? What are the concrete actions, what you do or what can be done in order to make the science community and the society more equal? So, Dr. Leine, you wanted to start.
Okay. First of all, it seems to me that you are definitely part of the solution and you're not part of the problem. And we often think that we talk that us and them, and that tends to come out as women and men. But it's really these unconscious biases that women have as much as men. There have been plenty of studies documenting that women scientists can discriminate against women, even when they're not conscious of doing so. So I think that part of the solution is to just keep this discussion going so that we recognize that we tend to be biased and so that we act against our own impulses to some extent. And I think that's also partly in education at whatever level that happens. That's a critical thing. And for our practical things in my everyday life, well, I lead a research group and I've recruited a diversity of people from different countries, and I think currently about 50% male, 50% women. And I have to think hard that I don't give specific kinds of projects to specific kinds of people. I have to think that I don't give risky projects to men, the easy ones to women. Sometimes it's easy to think that, well, women are good at doing what you tell them to do, so I'll give them this project and this kind of high risk, high gain to some. And so always check yourself that you're not making any biased solutions and really treat your young people in your lab with completely equally. And then, I guess, at home, try to raise your children in that respect too.
Okay, Professor Jokinen, what about you? Do you have some concrete actions in mind what could be done in increasing the equality?
Well, of course, I try to behave at home. It means that when my first child was born, I took half a year's parental leave, and then I did the same for the second and third child as well. And we have tried to divide the domestic work equally at home. And for example, nowadays my wife is working in Helsinki, which means that we are a single parent family during the from Monday to Friday, and I take care of all the dishing and washing and cooking and shopping and etc. And I don't enjoy it, of course, and I don't know whether it's good for my personality or not, but I think that it makes our family and the whole life more flexible, and it also teaches in practice our children that there can be differences, of course, between men and women and between women and between men, but they don't have to be unequal differences. And so I try to teach them that inequalities is something we don't have to accept, and we can really do something personally. But then, of course, at university, I also try to work with women and men in the same way. And for example, when I am teaching and when I talk with my students, I think that I almost always have a gender aspect in my mind when I'm doing something, communicating with people. And I think that, as you said, that what is very important is communication, and that we are conscious of this and every day. And it's not only what we do, but it's a very different kind of very practical things and uncommon, etc. And gender aspect is very important to keep in our minds and try to really in our everyday life to behave so that we do not deepen these inequalities, but that we help people to learn to live an equal life. But then, as I have said before, there are also structures in labor markets and homes and in our society, and it is possible to change them, but it takes time, and it's a huge task, but we can do that, but it takes at least 100 or 200 years probably.
Okay, Professor Swan, do you have something you would like to add to these previous comments?
No, I'm just saying by being here, that's good. You're aware, and you should try and act on it.
Okay, Lecturer Huttunen, what about you? What kind of concrete things you have in mind in context of this issue?
As a father, it has always been important to me to take all the possible family leaves, paternity leaves, even maternity leaves, if possible, and to be with children and to take care of them and to, as you said, to try to raise your own children, especially your daughters, to be self-confident and to break the class ceilings, whatever they are. And I have 4 daughters altogether and 1 son. The oldest daughter is now as a vice president in an international enterprise. And I'm very proud of her choices. And she has got a husband who is cooking all the time, and she cannot cook at all, and I'm very proud about that too. And as to my working life, I can say honestly that I have always loved all my female bosses, and I have been loyal for them. Also to you, I know. And I would say that there's nothing threatening with female bosses. They are doing very well, and I like to be working for them. I have always liked to be. So what's the problem there? I cannot understand. I mean, with men, all men should do that.
Okay, what about Dr. Harjunen? Do you have comments or suggestions?
I think this is the easiest for me because I actually do this for a living. I teach students about gender equality, intersectionality. I take part in public discussion in academia about these issues. I'm very passionate about these issues, so I love feminism. So I'd say that so far I have taught over 2,000 students already, so I think it qualifies for some kind of a gender equality awareness raising project.
Yes, definitely. I'm sure that all of us agree on that. What about Rector Sallinen? What are your comments on this issue?
Let me take only one example of my career as rector. So in the 90s, when I wanted to nominate a task group, I almost always had to ask for some female groups, female members in the group. But what happened from 2000, I almost always had to ask for more men in groups. I think it is equality question in that sense. So to have a good balance between female and male also within the academia. And when I'm now retired and emerita, so what I do right now in my current life, so I'm speaking about these issues in Finland, in many, I have been asked, and I am being asked to speak about these issues in many places around the country, and also particularly in Japan. I have given many lectures about gender issues in Finland, in Japan, and lately in Arabic countries, particularly in the United Emirates and Saudi Arabia. I have negotiated big things in Saudi Arabia with the sheikhs, only with men, with good results, I must tell, because Finland has a very good reputation in education, and for instance, the Arabic countries are particularly interested in Finnish education and the Finnish success in education and want to hear about it and want to conduct some joint projects in education. So that's what I'm doing, and I'm also writing about these things, and I think now I have more time also to support my daughter and her international career and her family as an international family, and my lovely granddaughter who is 3 years old. So I'm very sensitive in these issues, equality issues with her. So that's what I'm doing right now. And also I'm doing mentoring that Päivi was mentioned. For instance, now I live in Helsinki, and for instance today here in Jyväskylä I have met some female people from the campus, and we have had mentoring sessions. So I truly support also by mentoring female scientists.
Just one concrete example, what I'm trying to do is that when I'm evaluating, for example, research proposals or even checking up the exams of the students, I never look at the name. I try to avoid looking at the name, just not to put a face and the paper together or get an impression. Of course, sometimes you see the name when you read it, but then I just try to, it's a conscious choice not to think about the gender. And that's what I was referring earlier. I would like to think that only the scientific competence matters, for example, in applying money. So that's where I'm particularly accurate. And then I want to mention that my research group has a history of being female-oriented. But now we have also one man working at my research group, so I don't know which way I should say that it's going, but I think that also when hiring people, I want to think that I don't think about the gender. It has been a coincidence that most of them have been female.
Okay, and Professor Törmä.
Yeah, so I'm trying very hard every day to be a role model, and of course, I mean, not everybody should be like me. There are many kind of personalities, and everybody should be the type of personality that they are, but I think it's good for people to see that some women can do what they want to do, and others can also follow. Then I also try to, let's say, think about equality for men in the sense that I take into account that they also, when they have small children, they have hard time at home, that they have many, many duties. And then I try to do some kind of active mentoring. I monitor the young, talented females around, and when I see that, oh, there is one who could have an academic career, I go and show interest in what are your plans and so on. And last thing, I have two sons, and when they go for birthdays of some girls in their class and so on, I try to choose some interesting presents and not just the Barbie doll. It's horrible in the shop when you... So I have bought a book about astronomy for one girl, and for one girl, these geomag things that make you think three-dimensional, and for one about the human body, but maybe she goes to med school, maybe that was a mistake. And now I can promise that one day I will have enough courage to buy a Lego Technic for one of the girls.
Okay, I think we have had a really, really intriguing, really important, and really thought-provoking discussion this evening in here. Today, I really want to thank all of the panelists for coming here to discuss about this very important subject. And I also would like to thank the audience for participating in this public event, Women in Science and Society, of the 23rd Jyväskylä Summer School. I would now like to close the discussion and wish all of you a very pleasant rest of the evening. Thank you very much.